I've made some of the most valuable discoveries in my life with a spade in my hand. When I started transitioning out of law practice, I knew I would need to spend some time letting that experience recede. It was such an intense and absorbing form of problem solving, especially after 25 years. It felt like I hardly knew anything else. I needed to reflect on what to do with my life rather than jumping quickly into some other form of problem-solving work. Some close friends suggested I take up gardening to help this process along. So I did. At first, the law practice work was still so demanding that the only time I could find for gardening was late at night. I'd actually get out there with floodlights on and plant stuff. Eventually, even I could see how absurd this was. I named this form of gardening plant slamming, as if the only real point was to inject flowers and shrubs into the earth as rapidly as possible. When I told some other men at my church this story, they shot me looks of recognition. They were soul brothers. They too had plant slammed. I gradually made more and more room for gardening. I really got into it. The gardening experience became intense and absorbing. Before very long, I had gardened enough to create a whole new and expanded garden. I invited those close friends over to see what I had done. They looked at it, nodded, said, "Yep, you pressed and moored the garden." They also praised it and assigned themselves the job of coming over regularly to relax it, to make sure it didn't go to waste. That was an important job because I had solved the garden problem, you see, and I was not going to just sit there in the garden myself. I was moving on to the next problem. When I realized I had turned my garden into a problem to be solved, I began to appreciate how difficult the transition away from law practice was going to be. I knew my addiction to problem solving couldn't possibly be all my fault, so I looked around for someone else to blame. And finally, I found the culprit. It was a guy named René. René Descartes. After looking into Descartes' work as a philosopher and mathematician, I became convinced that we were related by blood, that I was suffering from hereditary addictive tendencies that indeed were not my fault. It was around 1640 that Descartes said something in Latin that became quite famous: "Cogito ergo sum." I think, therefore, I am. Descartes offered new answers to very old questions about human life. Questions like, "Who am I?" "I think, therefore, I am" is awfully close to "I am my mind," or even "I am my thoughts." Questions like, "Who or what is in charge in the universe?" To most people of Descartes' day, the answer to this question was God. What they heard him saying, though, is we humans are in charge, or more precisely, our minds are. We're all familiar with what happened for the next few hundred years after Descartes. Progress. Lots of progress. Lots of problems solved. The problem solving was breathtaking. We might even say miraculous. So it's not hard to see why so many people embraced rational thinking so enthusiastically. One might even say fervently. The mind solved more and more problems, expanding the acreage of life's territory under its control. This gave human beings the very good feeling that they were in control. And we humans tend to assume that more is better. So we eventually got to the point where it seemed natural and obvious that the rational mind was running and ought to be running pretty much everything. This led in turn to the dominance of two particular modes of engaging the world: utilitarian language and math. I say utilitarian in order to distinguish away other forms of language, like poetry, for example, that are not very relevant to problem solving. The mind uses these language and math tools to problem solve by performing three operations: comparison, classification, and counting. Everything is given a name or classification, which determines how the mind will relate to it. The names are arranged in a pattern that achieves a result. The result is compared with the problem by some form of measurement or counting. If the result compares favorably with the problem, we call it a solution. The more we used language and math, the more rational we became. The more rational we became, the more we lived and breathed language and math, until eventually we became what I would call hyper-rational. In reaching its hyper-rational stage, the Age of Reason supplied more new answers to very old questions. Questions like, what is my purpose? And the answer was problem solving as an end in itself. The jug wants water to carry, and humans want problems to solve. And questions like, how do I know what I know? And the hyper-rational answer was by using language and math in a process called reasoning. This meant if I cannot classify it, compare it, and count it, it doesn't exist. Until recently, one very old question continued to elude the vast reach of the Age of Reason. What does my death mean? Now, it has always seemed to me that religious leaders took comfort in the certainty of death, maybe because it was the one piece of life's territory about which the Age of Reason had so little to say. But lately comes an answer from Reason's accomplice, science. Your death means very little because we are going to postpone it indefinitely. Out beyond the outer reaches of your Microsoft Outlook calendar. Soon, the possibility will be real and visible that with enough science and medicine to replace every body part that could possibly wear out, a person might never die. That possibility will be enough to change what death means, and thus what it means to be alive. These five very old questions, answered newly by the Age of Reason, are the five compelling questions every religion has always been answering. In its present-day hyper-rational form, the Age of Reason has become a religion, the Church of Hyper-Rationality. It has answered all five of the compelling religious questions. Descartes' answer to the question, who or what is in charge in the universe, deserves a closer look. Descartes is credited with launching the Age of Reason, a kind of perpetual celebration of human intellect. So it may surprise you to learn that he wrote about God, and in a way that seemed to suggest he saw God as ultimately in charge in the universe. He refers to God as a substance that is infinite, independent, all-knowing, all-powerful, and by which everything else must have been created. But what he allows in this declaration, he immediately negates by offering a highly abstract, logical proof that God must exist. In essence, that it just wouldn't be logical for God not to exist. But if God depends on the dictates of anything, even an idea or method of thinking, then God is not ultimate. Not really God after all. Instead, that idea or method is ultimate, which is to say, is God. Descartes worshipped reason, and so do we. But even an idolatrous religion, like reason worship, is still a religion. The important question is whether this most popular of modern religions moves us toward fulfillment, wholeness, the nurturance of our souls. What is your observation? I see a reason-dominated world filled with unfulfilled people, starved for spiritual nourishment. The Church of Hyper-Rationality has provided answers to the five compelling religious questions that do not fulfill. And that's because these answers are not true. Our purpose isn't just problem-solving. We are not our minds or our thoughts. We're human beings with spiritual powers and needs trying to move toward wholeness. We are not in charge in human life, nor are our minds, nor is reason, which is a useful but inherently incomplete and imperfect tool for engaging our world. As for death, being alive is meaningless without it. And if we had to live a life with no authentic purpose, looking at everything through logic-colored glasses, and using rationality to pretend we're in control, who would want to live forever anyway? Descartes' answer to the religious question, how do we know what we know, is worse than unfulfilling. We cannot effectively engage the world only through reason. That's not the only way we know what we know. And to act as if it is causes profound spiritual damage. Once the hyper-rational mental cycle of classification, comparison, and counting becomes automatic, everything gets treated as comparable to everything else. Caught in this cycle, a human being inevitably will treat his own self as comparable too, which is to say, as just another problem to be solved. No one has ever been transformed spiritually by being treated as a problem to be solved. Rational engagement of the world is about comprehending, as Hans said, grasping through understanding. Religious engagement of the world is rational, but it also is very much about apprehending. Becoming aware through a sensual experience without the reductionism of explanation and understanding. It is about being present in the world and with the world and letting the world transform us instead of the other way around. And through this transformation, arriving at new spiritual places that are closer and closer to the holy. To wholeness. When we apprehend the world and ourselves in it without insisting on solving anything or anybody, we open ourselves to that experience of astonishment per se, of which the poet Szymborska spoke in her Nobel lecture. Szymborska makes it plain that she is referring not to exceptionally beautiful things as calling forth astonishment, but rather every single thing in the world. In our tightly organized lives of endless problem solving, do we ever really see the world in this way? beauty everywhere rather than something exceptional? Or does that seeing require moments of stillness that we tell ourselves we can't afford? Stillness. Motion and time receding, effacing themselves. An experience of watching an immense locomotive come to a stop. Its last steamy exertions pushing the wheels through one more revolution. At what station have we finally arrived when this happens? What name should we give to a place that opens us to a motionless, timeless perspective? Szymborska sees a puzzle in human astonishment at the world, since we have no standard of comparison by which to judge it astonishing. From a purely finite perspective, she has to be right. An obvious frog is not astonishing to another obvious frog, nor a stone to a stone. But as the wise poet says, a human being has the capacity to experience every single bit of our world as astonishing per se. Why? Because embedded in every human being is the one perspective from which these finite things are anything but obvious. The perspective of the infinite. The God's eye view. Astonishment per se is God peering through the lens of a human life, apprehending the finite world and blinking in unmitigated wonder. When this happens to a human being, better to say perhaps through a human being, it is transformative. Every place and every person in modern life is affected by hyper-rationality, including church and including ministers. For a problem-solving hammer like me, church is just full of carpentry opportunities. It's a seductive environment for problem-solving because presented with one more challenge, I can always say it's for an extraordinarily good cause. The challenges to be met are limited only by how broadly I cast my gaze. And if we run out of challenges within our own walls, there's always a broken world out there waiting to be fixed. Being a problem solver for our church is an important part of my job. But the further I go into ministry, the more it looks like the most important part of the job really isn't about problem solving at all. It's about being present. That might make it sound like being a minister is just a matter of showing up. But I'm talking about showing up in a very particular way. I'm talking about apprehending instead of comprehending and problem solving. If I am present with one or more of you in a way that says, you are astonishing per se. Not compared to anything else or anyone else. Indeed, quite beyond comparison. Then there is a chance for us to make a difference that can be felt in our very souls. That's how rare and valuable that message is when delivered from the heart. The possibilities opened up when people are with each other in this way utterly dwarf the problem-solving potential of the world's consummate practitioners of Cartesian rationalism combined. But it's not an easy thing to do. For me, the first part of the challenge is accepting that all those finely honed problem-solving skills on which I have traded for so long actually might not be what is most wanted and needed. And here's an even harder part. No amount of commitment to being present with others in this way will make any difference unless I can be present with myself in that way too. What is your ministry? I hope you didn't think ministry was only for ministers. What's your mission? What difference do you long to make? And for whom? And at what cost? For your own sake, don't pick a cheap one. Among the people in your own circle of family, friends, and community, and even beyond, who might need to hear that life-altering message from someone just like you, saying, "You are astonishing per se"? When we had that recent spell of unseasonably warm weather, Jennifer and I took a kayak down to Powhatan Creek. My kayaking skills are on the low end of amateur, but I took a turn in it. I paddled out into the creek, and there it was. Wislawa Zimborska's world. Astonishing, per se. It wasn't picture postcard beauty. The vistas weren't grandiose enough for that. Rotting logs in the water. Brackish. Shallow. Reedy. Trees standing knee-deep in the creek. No real demarcation of where land stopped and water started. A place teeming with messy nature. A life-nourishing habitat, innocent of shaping, naming, characterization, explaining, typology. Sitting in the kayak, leaning on the shoulder of the blue air, I had not the slightest desire to solve it. The only thing to do was be with it, be affected by it, and be with myself in that same way. Astonishing per se. Can you allow the possibility that you're being truly present with yourself, with your world, and with even another person could make all the difference.